772 for both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is now coming up on 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On the brink of yet another Olympic Games about to open in Paris, I'm excited to be able to speak today on the Morning Show with somebody who has been involved in the world of track and field for quite some time. His name is Mike DeWitt, and I suspect that a lot of you recognize the name of Mike DeWitt. First of all, he is a 72 UW Parkside grad. He is a military veteran. He is a retired teacher from the Racine Unified School District. And for a time, he was the track coach at UW Parkside and is now the track coach at Case High School in Racine. And at the recent Olympic trials, the three top female race walkers, at least at a certain distance, maybe the 20K, were all people who had runners, who had walkers, we should say, who had attended the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Two of them graduated from Parkside, and they were all coached at Parkside by Mike DeWitt. But sadly, they will not be competing at these upcoming Olympic Games because of some changes that have been made. And in a sense, a drastic shift in emphasis away from race walking. And there are some complicated, interesting factors at play in making this happen. But the sad fact of the matter is for the first time since 1904, the U.S. will not have any race walkers competing at the Olympic Games. So it's a situation that we need to talk about, of course, but we also, beyond that, want to talk about just what it means to compete at this elite level, what it means to coach athletes competing at this elite level, and what might be ahead for the sport of race walking and some of the things that make it particularly challenging. And Mike DeWitt was an All-American race walker once upon a time. So there is a lot to talk about, and I'm so glad that Mike DeWitt has made time in his schedule to be my morning show guest today. Mike DeWitt, we welcome you.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be here and just a chance to talk a little bit about track and field, race walking in particular. But, you know, I have a lot of different experiences across the track and fields that ask questions. I'm happy to chat away.
Great. And by the way, in your teaching career at, in Racine Unified. What did you teach?
Mostly intermediate grades from predominantly fifth graders, and I taught at the Lighthouse program in the early 80s, and then the schedule was a little bit difficult for coaching college kids at Parkside, because first off, it changed every year, and plus I was the only guy in the building. When you have a meeting with 30 women and one guy, you can see which guy is missing real fast. So, and then I was at Mitchell Elementary, all elementary school all the time, just because it was easier. It's just there's less responsibilities after school for elementary teachers, so I didn't have to worry about conflicts of trying to be in two places at the same time, of which I've done many a time. Some people wonder how I can be in two places at one time. I've got some good stories on that.
Yeah.
But
and what, just general ed? Yeah, or were you a PE teacher?
Fifth grade classroom.
Good. Mm-hmm. Well, and did I say it correctly, though, that you are doing some track coaching at Case High School?
Right. I'm starting my seventh year at Case High School. Basically, I coached Parkside for 29 years. I even coached here at Gateway for 4 years when they had a program.
Right.
From 70, actually a couple, there was two of those years I was coaching the Gateway kids and the Parkside kids. And because it worked out fine, they're just down the block here and we worked it out that way. And altogether, 40 years of college coaching. I did a few years after I left Parkside in 2010. I was down at Ave Maria University, started the program down there. I went to Belmont Abbey College in Charlotte area, got the program started there. Went up to Illinois Springfield, started the program there, because basically I was the women's coach for a long time and then took over the men's program and kind of got that restarted again. And so I had a little niche that worked really good to get some programs going. And along the way, too, I did 1 year in Birmingham. My wife and I taught together in Birmingham, Alabama for a year, Bessemer, Alabama, which is the most violent city in the country. It was a very interesting year.
Wow. You could probably write a book, and maybe should.
People ask me, but they don't want to see my writing. My wife's the English teacher. She kills my writing all the time. So
tell us a little bit about where you are from originally, and at what point track and field became an important part of your life, and then we'll get into the specific matter of when race walking became something important to you.
There you go. Yes, I was born in Kenosha and over at the old St. Catherine's Hospital, and grew up on the north side of town till 10 years old, then south side of town, and went to St. George, graduated from there, then was the first full 3 years over at Tremper to graduate. Because I graduated in 68, that was the first class that was there for all 3 years of high school.
In that actual
building. Yeah, in the building. The year ahead of us didn't start till middle of the year. And then went to Parkside the first 4 years it was open. And I always like to say, well, I graduated, Tremper was so big at the time, I graduated from Tremper at the Carthage Fieldhouse, and I graduated from Parkside at the Tremper Auditorium.
There you go.
Beyond that, after Parkside, was one of the last few people drafted, and took an extra year just because I had an opportunity to be on the U.S. Army track team at the time, and that worked out fine. After that, lived in 3 years of military service, 1 year in Colorado, and then 2 years down at Fort Sheridan. Actually worked out pretty well. Then first teaching job was teaching for 4 years out at Arizona, or out in Phoenix, and got my master's degree in elementary ed at the time too. And then we moved back here in 79 when we were raising the rest of our family and stayed here for 30 years. As the kids grew up and got going, and then we decided to play around for about 8 years there and came back here because it's home.
Right. So at what point did you become interested in track? And was that just one of an array of athletic endeavors earlier in your life?
In ninth grade, I tried to play football, but at 150 pounds and get run over, and I couldn't see. My dad wouldn't let me play with my glasses on, so that didn't work too well. Then I started running cross-country at Tremper for 3 years and played basketball, not very good. And I was good at keeping the bench warm. And I played baseball. Baseball was my favorite sport and got to play for Andy Smith and had a good time playing baseball. So I didn't really – after I graduated in 68, there was not all the club sports and stuff. And I had a small stint with the Kenosha Pirates back in the day. They needed an extra catcher, and so I didn't play too much. And I always like to say I couldn't hit my weight in 160. It's not a very good batting average. But I could always go run by myself. So I started running then, and I did like 6 weeks out of high school, I ran a marathon. You know, and the longest run I ever did before that was stop and go for about 14 miles.
Wow.
And so this that got me going there. And then Parkside started, and they got the program going there. And by the time I was a senior in the 71-72 school year, the NAIA, which is a little small sister of NCAA, they added the race walk. And I learned how to race walk a little bit, but once they knew it was a national championship event, and that was, I got a chance to make All-American there in the indoors and outdoors, and 72 qualified for the trials and kind of went from there.
Hmm. So I'm just curious. So first of all, at what age then were you when you first explored this thing called race walking?
It was on Thanksgiving Day of my sophomore year. So I was just turned 19.
Okay.
Because I was young. I graduated when I was still 17 and stuff like that. So I just turned 19, and we were down. My dad took me down to a little Thanksgiving turkey run before that was very fashionable. It was like 50 college kids running a little cross-country race down at Reese Park. And one of the members of the club that was putting it on said, "Hey, I got a novice race walk over here if you want to come over to the track." And I didn't run very fast. I had a lot of energy left. And so I went over and race walk, and I won. That's the first race I ever won.
Wow.
And not that I destroyed everybody, but, you know, he said, "Why don't you come down and do a few races and stuff?" And it worked out pretty well that way. So
yeah,
kind of got me going from there.
So maybe this is as good a time as any to just take a second and have you explain exactly what race walking is compared to, I mean, the more commonly seen track events, which involve, obviously, runners running mm-hmm. as fast as they can run. And of course, race walking is, I mean, as the name suggests, is a very different endeavor, and there are very specific things you have to do in order for it to remain race walking and not something else. So explain what that is, how that works.
Two basic rules are, one, you always have to have contact with the ground. So technically, and I like to say technical, I'll explain that in a second, you have to have your rear foot, your trail foot on the ground when your lead foot hits the ground. So you have to have like an instant of double contact. So you're not running, you're always up in the air. You know, even the slow runners are up in the air for a brief moment. And that's the first thing. And then the second part is that your knee has to be straight, not hyperextended, but straight on contact when your front foot hits the ground. And it has to stay straight until it's horizontal. You know, it has to stay straight for that instant, just all the way through. Then you can, you know, otherwise it's not stiff-legged walking, because then you can bend your knee after that point too. So, and then it can only be at this point in time. They're working on kind of come up with some mechanical judging that they could use that way, but sort of like fencing with touches and stuff like that, if you know anything about fencing. And so only the human eye can judge it. So if there are on a course or on a track, there's usually 4, 6, or 8 judges, depending on how long the course is. It's a loop course most of the time, not point to point like a marathon. They do usually maybe 500 meters down, 500 meters back, or 1,000 meters down, 1,000 meters back. And the judges are watching all the time, and they can give you cautions to tell you that you're getting kind of close to not right. And then if three judges think that you are breaking the rules, you're either basically running or you're not straightening your knee, it takes three judges to disqualify you. And usually if you get three, you usually get 4 or 5. There's another couple little nuances in there too. If you get 3 red cards from a judge, yellow is caution to let you know that you're getting close. If you get 3, you have to go into a little penalty box. And if it's like a 10K, you have to stay in a penalty box for a minute.
And it's literally like a penalty box, it's a hockey game.
Except for it's just a little coned off and stuff,
sure.
So you don't have to jump the fence.
right.
And you have to, you know, you lose that time, so. And then if you jump back on the course and you get up a 4th card, then you get disqualified as well. So, and that happens to some people. Because basically if you're contending for the lead and you have to spend that minute in a penalty box or 2 minutes in a 20K, 12 and a half miles, you're not going to catch up. So it slows people down a little bit too. So
now these errors, let's call them errors, that a race walker might make where suddenly they're not race walking anymore. They're just kind of semi-running or whatever. Mm-hmm. Is that the kind of thing that is much more apt to happen with young and inexperienced runners? Or even when we're talking about somebody, for instance, competing in the Olympic trials, mm-hmm. do we see really fine race walkers making those kind of mistakes, being cited with those kind of penalties?
As a whole, the higher level you go up, they're actually harder to judge because the human eye can only judge to about 180 strides per second where they can actually see some air. So you have to be, you know, an inch or two off the ground with the loss of contact, which is at the elite levels is what generally people will get disqualified for. They basically start running. They're not making good enough contact. The beginning people and the youngsters and stuff, they tend not to straighten their knee. And that's really easy to see. You can see when someone's walking like Groucho Marx, if you know who Groucho Marx is.
Right. So when a judge sees that Mike DeWitt is doing something wrong, what are exactly the logistics by which that, first of all, warning is issued? I mean, and how does Mike DeWitt know that you're the one who's being cited?
Well, each judge that's on the course is well-defined with a uniform of sorts, depends on the event and stuff. So they have a yellow paddle, and one of the paddles has a little wavy line on it, which means that they think that you're getting close to losing contact. You might even be losing contact with just saying settle down. And a good judging will just try to keep the race fair anyways. I mean, instead of just automatically disqualifying anybody that's even remotely close. Or they have a paddle that has a little carrot sign on it, less than, greater than sign on it, that shows that their knee's not straight. And they'll just put that right in front of the walker, and they'll say the number in case.
So literally, physically right
you
in front of
it,
you.
You can see it, yeah. They'll either say it, and they'll show you the paddle, too, so you can't miss it. And then as the race goes along, there's usually a big board. There's an electronic board at the big events, at the Olympic Games, electronic board. So once a judge gives you that, they're not bound to give you a warning. If you're really bad, they can just turn in a red card. A red card, the judge won't tell you he's turning in a red card for you. Hmm. Otherwise, you could just run by him all the time because they can only turn one red card in on a person. So then there's a big board that it'll have a big X on it. It means that you got one red card. So that's okay. One red card is not the end of the world. Two red cards means you kind of better be a little more careful. And again, like I mentioned, three red cards, you got to do a timeout, basically, and then fourth one, you're disqualified. So, and there's always a chief judge that if someone does pick up that fourth card, the chief judge has a big red paddle that drops you out. So, you can see that too. There's, you know, the uneducated eye will seem that everybody's running, especially at the elite level. It's like, and you can take photographs of it, and you can see people off the ground, but only the human eye can judge it. So, and like I said, they're trying to come up with some force plate things, and they're working on it. I guess they've talked about it. I'm not sure how cost prohibitive it is. It might not be so bad right now, you know, with the technology that's out there, because it used to be, you know, really hard to try to make something inexpensive that can be useful for track without having to sell the farm to get it put in position. So,
wow.
But they'll have to come up with some kind of way to do that because, you know, generally everybody's going to get off the ground a little bit every now and then. So they might have to say, well, every 2% of the time you're off the ground, whatever they might be.
Right.
They haven't set it up yet, so.
This seems like this is very different from, you know, the standard, you know, 100-yard dash or the 400-meter hurdles or whatever, where, I mean, obviously they are watching very closely that starting, you know, the starting point, and we don't want false starts and that sort of thing. But it sort of feels like once you're running a 100-yard dash, in a sense, they don't care what you do, just you stay in your lane. But I mean, you can look weird or funny or ugly or whatever, but I mean, it's just running as fast as you can. Mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated by the notion that race walking is, in a sense, a much more specific discipline with a very specific kind of technique that needs to be adhered to. And
exactly.
It seems like that makes it drastically different from any of these other, in a sense, more commonly viewed marquee events.
Right. Well, the best way I describe that for people that, you know, there's a faction of people that think race walking doesn't belong because it's too hard to judge and everything else. But I always remind them a couple things about this, and you'll get the point as soon as I say this. So what's not strange about some guy running down a runway and jumping over 20 feet and landing in a pit? And what's different about some guy running up and trying to jump 7 feet over a bar? Or what's something of guys running over 10 hurdles or taking a bowling ball and trying to see how far he can throw it? Or taking a little, you know, 4-pound plate and see how far he can throw it? Or taking a spear and see how... It's all part of track and field. And in race walking is the only technical event, an endurance event. You know, because there's you know, if you're a fast runner, you might not be a super fast runner, but you might be a real good long jumper.
Right.
Or take, you know, hop, step, and jump.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the technical aspect to it. You have to work on technique. You have to spend time making sure that otherwise you're wasting your time training if you're going to get thrown out every time.
Sure.
And so that's really important to it. Even in distance events from basically the 800 on up, the only technical event is the race walk, unless you want to do the marathon, which is not really technical, but you got to run a long ways,
yeah.
Or the steeplechase, where you got to jump over the hurdles for 2 miles, you know, 3,000 meters. So that's why the niche is there for the race walk. It takes a specific ability. Most of the race walkers that I've had were athletes of some other sports that were pretty good athletes at it, too. There's some runners that can only run that I can't make race walk. They can't figure out how to race walk. They're not coordinated enough, if that's the right word. You just didn't have the abilities to handle that, the motion and everything else, too. So,
yeah. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on the morning show with Mike DeWitt, who is the track coach at Case High School, one of them. And he was the track coach at UW Parkside for a number of years. He himself is a UW Parkside graduate from 1972 and himself an All-American in track and field. And his specialty, the race walk. And as a matter of fact, the top three race walkers, female race walkers at the most recent Olympic Games, were all coached at one point or another by Mike DeWitt. Sadly, however, and we'll get to this in just a little bit, they will not be competing in Paris. The United States is not sending race walkers to the Paris Olympics, and this is the first time this has happened since 1904. Before we get to that and kind of the current state of the sport, I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about the particular physical requirements, at least generally speaking, in terms of being a successful race walker. Is it helpful for your body to be put together in such a way? Is it helpful to have maybe long limbs or loose joints or tight joints? Or, I mean, are there physical attributes that can be helpful, that can make a difference, that can make somebody, in a sense, a natural race walker? Or is it simply a matter of building the right technique, and that just about anybody with enough determination can do this?
Well, the number one thing that you would think would be the longer legs you have, the better you would be at it because you cover more ground.
Mm.
But I always go back to right at the beginning, Michelle Roll, who is the 58-year-old that finished third at the trials, and
yeah.
She's been on three Olympic teams. Michelle is under 5 feet tall and under 100 pounds.
Wow.
And she just has tremendous turnover, just can really have really good leg speed. She was a good middle distance runner. There's kind of two different athletes that fit in, because race walking up until the last Olympics, the distances were 50 kilometers, 31 miles, longer than a marathon, or 20 kilometers, which is 12 and a half miles. So basically you have to be a pretty good endurance athlete because you're walking for an hour and a half to, you know, depends who you are, hour and a half to less than hour and a half, hour and 15 minutes for the guys. And 4 hours to 4.5 hours for the 50K walk, 50-kilometer walk. So you have to be an endurance athlete, okay? But it also helps to be a good 5,000. You have to have good maybe 5,000-meter, 10,000-meter ability. Even 1,500-meter ability is pretty good too. So, but you have to have that, because you have to have good turnover to do that. So that's kind of the basic thing. You have the endurance factor and the turnover factor and stuff like that too. Then the next things that come into play is good natural athletic ability. You know, some of the guys that I've coached were wrestlers, and you know, I was a baseball player and basketball. So just some agility that comes in there. So you can good body control,
you know, and so knowing your own body,
body awareness and stuff like that too. And then two aspects that are very helpful for coaching are two ways to go. One, some people, you know, as an educator over the years too, there's people can learn by watching and then doing, or people have to do and then see what they did and then try to fix it that way too. It's a little bit different. So
yeah.
Finding the right, and as a rule, the guys can mimic other walkers all the time, and the girls have a harder time doing that. And so, say, you know, because I can say, well, walk like so-and-so, and they can do that, and walk like so-and-so, because I want you to fix that point there too. So, and we spend a lot of time each year finding that little technique keys for them. You know, the best walkers in the world are really strong core. They're very physically fit upper body, because you got to have some upper body strength to pump your arms. Mm. Definitely strong legs, strong hips, but strong core. So even to this day, I can lead the high school kids in core work, because I just have – I don't even know if it's natural core that I've had, or just because I still have strong core too. So I can, you know, lead the kids through stuff like that too all the time. So just that total body strength is important too. So then you have to have the mentality to keep going for 4.5 hours or 4 hours. That's
right.
That's a little bit different. You know, like the Tour de France that just finished, those guys are just working on their legs turnover, but you got to keep your whole body going and stuff like that too. So
right, and have a mental acuity that can go the distance very, 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 very literally. Yeah. And of course, it's also intriguing to think about athletes who are able to continue to compete at a very high level for a really, really long period of time. The very first race walker I ever met was doing this program. Debbie Lawrence,
for sure,
of course, from Kenosha, and who I believe competed in a total of 3 Olympic Games, and a couple of these women who just did so well in the recent Olympic trials also have multiple Olympic Games to their credit. Is that something that we often see in the sport of race walking, that people are able to do this for a long, long time, maybe sustaining their excellence better than, for instance, the typical sprinter or hurdler?
For sure, yeah. Because the endurance factor that comes with it, and the one thing, you know, that keeps me, I still run and race walk myself too, and without injuries and things over time, is because the key thing that, especially for the people that might be listening that just want to start walking more instead of, you know, that want to get in shape by running, well, the thing that I've done some biomechanic work with Kenosha and Ray Fredrickson, who is retired now, but he was over at Michigan State, and he was a Parkside grad and local, grew up family here. And so force plate, when you're race walking fast, you're only coming 1.25 times your body weight. Hmm. So when you're, any normal runner is going 3 times their body weight. So the pounding is a lot less.
Mm.
On, you know, for distance runners, marathoners break down after a while, after you do too many, especially the slower you go, the harder you hit the ground.
Yeah.
And race walking, when you're going, you know, for 4 hours and stuff, only 1.25 times your body, that's a lot less pounding on your legs over time too. And so, and just, and you know, so you don't get the injuries, the running injuries that always come up, the stress fractures and the, not that the walkers are healthy, but they'll have more muscular problems than they were. Mm. You know, if they just overwork, you know, if their technique's not good, they're going to overstress hamstrings or a quad muscle or an ankle, you know, different things like that. So,
right.
Yeah, that's the biggest point.
Hmm. So, when you are coaching race walkers, and I guess I'm even curious, even beyond specifically the event of race walking, but I've always been intrigued by what a track coach does. Because, you know, at least some of it, especially if you're coaching cross country, is just, you know, go run, and you may or may not be running with them. But I mean, it doesn't look the same as coaching football, for instance, mm-hmm. where there's X's and O's, and there's sort of a specificity to you know, building plays and getting people in different positions and so on. This just seems like a completely different endeavor, and not necessarily easier. Mm-hmm. But in some ways, maybe simpler.
Yeah. That's a good point. I always teach all the years I was at Parks. You know, I was a part-time coach. I was teaching elementary, and those rest of the coaches were basically full-time coaches. And I go, why can't you guys win any conference? I'm only here for a couple hours a day. And I go, well, that's because it's only running. Who cares?
Right.
I go, but basically, have every event, no matter what it is, whether it's race walking, whether it's coaching cross country, on the track and stuff like that, just having it takes a full plan, you know, full season plan. The biggest difference that most people would think about, well, in baseball, you got to win so many games to get to the playoffs. And in basketball, you got to win so many games to get to the tournament and everything else.
Yeah.
In track and cross country, you only got to be at your best one time to qualify for the next level. So all the little things that go about, you can set up all your training and stuff. And as a coach, that's one of the things I've always done. And anybody that works with me, sometimes the parents at the high school, they don't question it much, but they see it. By the time it's all done, just give me a chance. See the whole thing work out. You know, where so many examples I can give you where in a cross-country season, we might run against somebody in September and they might beat us by 20 points. And then we run against them in late October or early November, and we'll beat them by 20 points with the same people. Okay. Mm. Is that because our group wasn't in shape early in the season? No, because we were working on specific points of their race plan, whether it's learning how to pace better or work in the end of a race, you know, little things like that. So there's a lot of little nuances that go into it. And, you know, over the years and stuff, even in my classroom too, where you have to individualize almost every athlete.
Hmm.
Just individualize every student in the classroom too, basically what their strengths are. Well, you know, learn how they learn. You can learn how they're going to get better. With the high school kids, more so than the college kids, I always work with their strengths. With the walkers, I work with their strengths. If they have good endurance, then I can work on their speed. If they, you know, so I can, you know, just their speed will come with their endurance. I'll just work their endurance more so they'll get faster. And if they don't have real good endurance, but they have good technique, then I'll just do a lot of shorter stuff, but it just keep on stretching a little bit farther and stuff. So you just have to find those little fine tunes. It's an art and a science together. There's a science to it, definitely.
Sure.
But there's definitely an art to it too. It's just and I coach a lot by eye anyways too. So yeah. People ask me to write, I said I can't write it down. You just have to listen to me.
And just for instance, when it comes to these, I mean, these are probably the two most basic matters, working on a race walker's speed versus working on a race walker's endurance. Mm-hmm. So how does a coach do that? I mean, like, for instance, getting a race walker to be faster, what exactly is the path towards that, to achieving that goal?
Well, the way that I do it, there's not a book on the way that I do things, because I've used myself as the guinea pig all the time, because I always ran and race walked. Most race walkers really just race walk.
And you ran also.
I still run and race walk.
It
basically depends on what I was working at over time. If it was really trying to get better at a 50K race walk, which is what I was better at, walking 31 miles. You know, over the years, people around town here seem going back and forth from the north side of town to the Southport and along the lakefront and all over the countryside up to the mall, you name it. So we spend a lot of time just stretching out the distance, and even the newer kids, just taking some time to get them used to mentally and physically just moving, learn how to fuel, you know, because you always get, you know, if you're not going to be out there for more than an hour and a half, you're going to have to refuel, and just how to take care of that so you don't crash mentally. Physically, you'll just run out of fuel and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So learning how to do that, learning how to pace and just being able to keep on going and staying focused on your technique. So that's a little process where when I was at all the years at Parkside with the NAI, they used to just race walk 5,000 meters, 10,000 meters. And, of course, the Olympic distance, the national distance, goes to 20 kilometers, twice it is, 12 and a half miles. You know, and so you're just not going to take someone that can run race walk for an hour, 45 minutes, and all of a sudden try to get them for an hour and a half. So there's a little gap that you have to bridge the gap with them too. So
interesting. Mm-hmm. And I suppose some of those things are, the longer you coach, the more you just have a sense of that, and also have a better and better sense of responding to a particular race walker or athlete in whatever aspect of track and field, and you know what they need and you know how they can achieve it. I wonder if you could just take a second to tell us about these three women you coached at Parkside, who finished 1, 2, 3 in the most recent Olympic trials. We've already mentioned Michelle Roll, who finished third and who is 58 years old and still obviously race walking at a very high level. But maybe you could just say a quick word about each of these three talented women.
It's just they all have different backgrounds from when they got here. Michelle was from Beaver Dam, Wisconsin. Lady came down to run, and she was a pretty good runner. By the time she was done, she was All-American 15 different times. She won national titles in running, and only race walked a very little. When she was at Park, she had a little tweak on a quadricep or just a little something sort of. And basically, if you get hurt running, you can race walk, and it doesn't bother it at all. You can go back and forth for one. It depends what it is. About the only time that anything can bother it a little bit is if it's kind of an ankle or a foot thing. But basically, if it's a hamstring, usually a hamstring will hurt. Walkers will hurt in the middle of their hamstring, and a runner will hurt the upper hamstring, or vice versa. Sometimes it goes back and forth, so you can go back and forth. So we got her going. And then she was good enough to make it to the Olympic trials, just missed in 88 when she graduated, in the 1,500-meter run. She was a very good runner. I mean, she could run 4:40 mile, 4:38 mile.
Yeah,
that's fast for a girl, and it's fast for a guy too. And it costs money to go to meets that you could do that. She didn't have a sponsor, and you just, you know, kids out of, straight out of college don't have a whole lot of money. Mm. And so we said, well, you can race walk enough. We got her to race walk to qualify for USA Nationals just on a local race here. And she ended up making her 10th race ever was Olympic Games.
Wow.
You know, that's how much talent she had and stuff like that too. Then over the years too, she actually qualified. She could have qualified in the 1,500-meter run. She did qualify in the marathon. She ran the marathon in 96, but it conflicted with doing both. Mm. So she stuck with the walk a long time, too. So she still runs very fast right now, too. She set world and American records in 800 meters all the way up to 10,000 meters running. Mm. Then there's Miranda, who is second place. Miranda is from the Rochester, New York area. And I had one of my other guy walkers here that came from that area too, so she knew a little bit about us and stuff. And she came out not super talented as far as a runner goes, pretty fair runner, but no great shakes. But even as an 18-year-old, with a little bit of work, we went out, and she had a grandfather that lived out in Phoenix. We went out in January. She walked a marathon under 4 hours, and anybody knows marathons, 4 hours is kind of you got to work at it to get break 4 hours. She as an 18-year-old, she walked 4 hours for a marathon.
Wow.
And just that, you know, she had that good natural ability and good technique, too, and good flexibility. And then the first place girl, Robin Stevens, came out from California. She was fairly highly touted. She was the fastest high school runner that I think I ever had at Parkside. But she had some ability to race walk and stuff. But being from California, two winters out here was plenty.
Mm. So,
just missed going back to home and stuff like that,
sure.
too. And over time, she got things in order and stuff, and by the time she got to be her 30s, she got to be a pretty good walker. So, you know, all three of them have made it. Michelle made three Olympic teams. Miranda has made one Olympic team, and Robin has already made an Olympic team too. So
wow.
they had their chance to get there. So
absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, as we briefly touched on, none of these three talented women, skilled women, are headed for Paris. I mean, except as spectators maybe, mm-hmm. but I mean, they will not be competing in Paris. In other words, the United States will not be fielding any athletes competing in this particular event. Explain to our listeners kind of the sort of various factors that have led to this situation, a sad situation that has never been there since 1904.
Sure. There's kind of several key factors. First off, it starts with the International Olympic Committee. The International Olympic Committee cut the, and I don't have the exact numbers, I think they cut down from about 2,200 of each men or women athletes in the track and field events, and they dropped it down to 1,800. So they dropped off 300 or something like that, pretty close to that. And then the second thing they did is International Olympic Committee, the USA, the World Track and Field Federation, said, okay, we got to pair some numbers off. So they dropped about 40 people off of the marathon. They took out the 50-kilometer walk, which I just mentioned, which basically eliminated 48 athletes that would have been in the walk. Some of them do both races, but it's pretty much took care of about 45 because there were 60 in both races the last few Olympics. Okay, now it's down to one 20-kilometer race with only 48 walkers, so a whole bunch more got cut off. So that makes that. They added starting with 92, up before 1992, the first three finishers at the Olympic trials made the Olympic team. That was it. If you were third at the Olympic trials, you made the Olympic team. Plain and simple. Then in 92, they started adding a time standard.
Mm.
Okay. And then because they squeezed the numbers a little bit more, and then that makes the time standard tougher. Both the men and the women's time standard is faster than the American record right now. And there's been some pretty good walkers. It's faster than the American record.
Wow.
But they made it so fast that they also have a scale so that there's probably only about 25 of those qualified haven't gone that fast. So they'll fill out the field with another 23 on a rating system.
Mm.
And so by the time it comes down to that, the number one men walker in the country is about 60th. He would have made it last time. He was 62nd or 58th or something last time. He would have made it this time on the same schedule, but they only take 48. And the women, the best on the women's side this year is only right around 100th. And so, wow. And that's because our ladies are 38, 41, and 58.
Sure.
And along with that factor that goes in with our Parkside program that we had, in any given year we'd have as few as six and as many as a dozen walkers out here. And over the years, all those Olympic trials and stuff, there was many times with alumni and current kids and stuff, more than half the field would be kids that trained here.
It's wow.
Either at the same time or at a different time.
Huh.
And so that kind of, once Parkside dropped its NAIA affiliation, and I could still train some kids, but one of the ways that I developed kids was giving them to NAIA Nationals where they only had to walk 3,000. It could be pretty good.
Yeah.
And so all those little factors kind of came together at this point in time. So now the good point about it is the World Athletics Federation still has a 35-kilometer walk and a 20-kilometer walk, and the standards aren't as tough. So we still have a chance to get some people internationally at the highest level, second highest level. The World Track and Field Championships is every odd year.
Mm.
And so there's a chance for people to get there. And there's a World Cup every year, of which that's the highest level I got to, which is great. The World Cup is all nations can send a team of three walkers up to five walkers, or just individuals if they want to and stuff. And the U.S. is not – U.S. is in the middle third of the world when it comes to that.
Hmm.
And our better event has always been the longer one, the 50-kilometer. The U.S. team, the year that I walked in 1989, we finished fifth. The men's team finished fifth in the world, and which wow. was a lot of fun too. So,
when you are working with, for instance, young athletes at Case, is it – in a sense, a tough sell to get a young man or a young woman interested in race walking? I mean, and I only ask because it's something, as we've already talked about, really, really different from, you know, some of the more commonly encountered events.
Well, it is a little bit, but I've got a couple ways that it's been working real well. And that's even with the college kids, you know, I'll show you to walk. If you walk, I'll guarantee you get to Nationals. You know, so if you want to get the Nationals, that's the way you get there. And then if you get there Nationals, you want to get there again. And then either they're injured or not super fast, but get stronger, a little more confident. So with the high school kids, I can use part of this winter training and stuff like that, too, to teach them how to race walk a little bit, too. And then we host three or four track meets over at Parkside. Case High School coaches them. And since I'm the meet director, I put a race walk in. Okay. And I do two things with the race walk. One, I make it a scoring event, so other schools will try it because they'll try to score a few points on it too. Give a chance to opportunity to that. I give medals for it, and so that's pretty good enticement, and just to get them out there. And the third thing I do, which nobody does for race walking, is they usually put the race walk the very first thing when nobody's there, or the very last thing after everybody's gone. I put it right before the mile relay when everybody's still there. So everybody's watching it, and you know, it starts out a lot of snickers and laughing, but then it gets pretty serious when they see how fast they're going, and it's a lot of neat. So it gets other people involved. We've had, in the past 2 years that we've done that with the walkers, we've had over 30 different schools have had some kids try to race walk, which is nice. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. That's great to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So you just mentioned the fact that you are still race walking and you are still running.
That's right.
And I wonder this is obviously something that means a lot to you, but it's always been a part of your life. Is there any point for somebody who has never really engaged in this trying to take it up later in life?
I have a Wednesday night group that meets out at UW Parkside every Wednesday at 6 o'clock. Pretty much if it's really crummy out, we get inside, and we do that. And so it's for anybody that wants to. Here's what I have right now. I have a group of about half a dozen. I've got a 91-year-old guy that comes out, walks pretty regularly. And he's set some records. I've got a few people without hip replacements and stuff out there. I've got some that have been walking for a long time. I've got some that only just start up and things like that, or either broken down runners. A lot of those broken down runners can't run no more because their knees are shot, and because there's no pounding on your knees, even with artificial, they work so good too. So if you're any kind of curious, just show up at the UW Parkside track at 6 o'clock on a Wednesday night. We're always there, if rain or shine. I mean, it's pouring, like I said, if it's pouring buckets, we go inside. But
right.
And during the winter, we go inside. And so we're always around. So you want to, if you're curious, just want to see what's going on, you want a little lesson, come on out and join us. It's fine. I've got a group that some of the people I've been coaching for. Well, when I was gone here, my daughter and son picked it up for a while too. So some of the people I've started, I think probably all the way back to about 1985, 86, I've been coaching some of the people that have been out there that long. So I used to be the youngest in the group. Now I'm about as old as someone.
Funny how that goes.
Yep.
As for these Paris Olympics, even though there will be no American race walkers to watch, do you plan on watching a lot of the Olympics, or are you more of a doer than a spectator?
No, I'll definitely check the race walks, because one of the things I do when I watch race walks is I can just pick out technique things that help people I coach and stuff like that too. So, and I know several of the coaches around the world and stuff, and which is really nice to just have connections with that, and as well the athletes too. Not so much right now, but from the previous Olympics and from World Championships and stuff where I've had athletes too. So, yeah, I'll be watching that. And there's certain events that I just love. I love team handball. Most people don't even know what team handball is, but I just love, I got a chance to witness it back in 81 when I was out at the Air Force Academy where they used to have an Olympic festival. They had all the events in the Olympic Games and stuff, and I got a chance to watch that. And so I just like that. And the U.S. is not very good at it, but it's still fun. It's a really fun game. It's kind of a combination of volleyball and it's not handball. It's like on a basketball court and stuff. It's a little physical. U.S. is not very good. I don't even know if they've ever won an international game yet.
Hmm.
And the fencing, you know, Parks had fencing for a long time, and
oh, yeah.
I know quite a bit about fencing too. So, and I even just played around with it a little bit too. Not very good. But Coach Hine was always trying to get me to do it. I said, I'm going to go run. But I watch a lot of the different things too. So,
you know, when you're just kind of rattling all that off, it just is a nice way to underscore the fact that the Olympic Games are about so many different things. I mean, it's just this absolutely extraordinary celebration of so many different ways to be an athlete and so many different ways to achieve and demonstrate excellence. And I really appreciate this conversation that we've had. I have learned so much, and I suspect our listeners have as well, about the sport of race walking. And I do appreciate you making time for this. I hope we didn't interrupt a morning run for you to be part of the morning show today.
No, I'm sort of retired.
Sort of, kind of.
I've retired six times, but that's
right,
okay. So
right.
I'm still working, but not six times. Yeah. So I got time to get stuff done. Your problem.
Great. Well, great to have you here. Mike DeWitt, UW Parkside graduate, former UW Parkside track coach, current Case High School track coach, retired Racine Unified School District teacher, former All-American, and my guest today on the morning show. Thank you again, Mike DeWitt.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
So tomorrow on the morning show, I'm going to be interviewing the author of a really interesting book about improvisation. Randy Fertel is the author. The book is called Winging It. On Thursday, Dr. Art Sear will be joining us for his monthly visit to the program to offer his thoughts on current events and issues, including, of course, the dramatic shakeup in the presidential race on the Democratic side. And on Friday, an interesting, fun grab bag of various interviews from the Morning Show archives related to the Olympics, including conversations that I recorded with medal award-winning identical twins Paul and Morgan Hamm, gymnasts from Waukesha, and also an interview that I recorded with platform diver Jordan Windle, talking about their Olympic experiences. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. And don't forget that you can also hear the morning show as a podcast to enjoy a different morning show 7 days a week. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Subscribe and listen, and if you are so inclined, please leave a review. We're approaching 9 o'clock. Here we go. Today will be mostly sunny, but a 50% chance of rain developing this afternoon, possibly strong thunderstorms. A high of 83 degrees, a 50% chance of rain tonight, low of 64, a 40% chance of rain tomorrow with a high of 79. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. WPR News,